Welcome to Energy in Action. I'm your host, Marcy Young, and as a Mito patient myself, I appreciate you and the community you've helped us to build. This podcast honors the triumphs and struggles of patients and families affected by this disease and celebrates the work being done by doctors and researchers every day to make it a safer world for our people. We are a support group and a podcast focusing on all things related to mitochondrial disease. Welcome to another episode of Energy in Action, and today I am joined by someone very special, Crystal Barrett O'Loughlin. She is the founder and the CEO of Rare Givers, an organization that when I learned about it, I thought, oh my gosh, I wish I could have benefited from this when my mom was still alive. And I have thoroughly gone through all of their services and the things that they can do for the community. And I cannot wait for you to learn about this organization as well. So welcome, Crystal. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much, Marcy. I am so excited to join today.
Well, the mitochondrial disease community is a special group of people, and there's a lot of fighters, but it's a lot of disease that, you know, can run the whole lifetime, you know, and the progression of it all is very sad and scary. And, you know, everybody has loved ones and those loved ones are caring, you know, for us. And it can be a really tricky road. So there's not enough organizations that sing the song that you're singing, you know, and I was so impressed with you. Crystal actually did a TED talk on the topic. So that could be something else that you might want to listen to. But share with us a little bit about your background and what drew you to building this organization. I think that's a good place to start.
Sure, absolutely. Well, we have so many extraordinary stories in the rare and chronic disease community. And mine started at birth. I am the youngest of five children. My parents, Richard and Phyllis, met in high school. They married at 19 and they told their pediatrician, watch out for us. We want a really big family. And they just had children in rapid succession about every 18 months. Three of my four older brothers were born with a rare genetic disease called Hunter's syndrome. The clinical name is mucopolysaccharidosis. So muco is mucus, poly is a lot, and saccharidosis is sugar. So they were lacking the enzyme that they needed to break down certain types of glucose in their body. And over time, that impeded their growth. They developed a second, third grade level vocabulary and then regressed from there. And so my brothers passed away at 12, 18, and 19 years old back in the 1980s. And you can imagine the whole family was organized around the caregiving for my brothers. And it was stressful. It was difficult. There was no internet back then. There was very little resources. It was a lot of guesswork on how to bring relief into their life. And I'd like to say that we found really beautiful, joyful moments as a family. But the stress of the caregiving did break my parents apart. They divorced in 1975. And if you stick around to the end of this podcast, I'll give you a Hollywood ending like you've never heard before. Just a little foreshadowing on that. But really, truly, it's the personal lived experience that drives my passion for bringing emotional relief into our global community today.
Yeah, that had to have been a huge impact on your childhood. How is the closeness of you and your living brother today?
You've
gone through a lot together.
We have, yes. Yeah, so we're connected at a heart level. We're 8 years apart, so he's the oldest. I'm the youngest. My mother didn't know that she was a carrier. I have the benefit of that knowledge. That being said, I was cared for. So my oldest brother was kind of in lockstep with my mom, changing diapers and clearing lungs at night and, you know, helping with the caregiving responsibilities. And so I really have a heart for him and his journey. He's a really wonderful uncle to my daughter, Chloe, who is also a carrier. So we have three generations of carriers, and my brother, you know, does his best to show up in the ways that he can for our family. That being said, I think, you know, there's definitely some kind of lived trauma there. And we talk lightly about it. I call him my Buddha. You know, he's always really, he's very chill and very mellow. And I'm very like high energy. And so he's always like, ah, sister, you're so stressed out, you know, relax a little bit. He lives in Hawaii. He has a boat in Waikiki Harbor. So he's very connected to the wind and the weather patterns and the moon and the stars. And, you know, that's how we kind of catch our stride with each other.
That's a cool lifestyle. It's very not me, but I really commend those who can, you know, live differently and find so much joy in it, you know?
Yes, it's a you know, it's a practice of presence, sort of living in the moment, kind of those ancient arts that have been lost in our modern culture, I feel like, that we have to kind of remind ourselves to do the things that we know are the most important, taking deep breaths, pausing for moments of gratitude, getting out in nature, eating well, you know, swimming and walking and exercising and all of those things that we know we should be doing that we tend to, you know, write off as we're just too busy
yeah.
to do.
Yeah. And life can go fast and can be life very goes, scary out of nowhere.
Yeah, it yeah. does. It does. And we kind of look outside ourselves. We look to doctors, we look to healthcare professionals to, you know, to bring the emotional relief in addition to symptom relief. But we often look outside ourselves for that emotional relief. And really, the emotional relief is within us. It's available to us. It's approachable. But we just kind of need to be reminded. So a lot of what we do at Rare Givers is reminding people that it's okay to put yourself first. In fact, it's really important, whether you're a young adult or an adult living with a rare or chronic condition, or you're a caregiver caring for a loved one, and it's not always parents, you know, certainly with adult onset diseases, we have spouses and, you know, other family members, siblings like myself, but also aunts and uncles and grandparents and teachers and, you know, the whole healthcare community. So we view Rare Givers as really not a single person in the ecosystem. It's really this concept that we're all Rare Givers. We're all caring for ourselves or caring for loved ones, whether it's, you know, in a love sort of family way or in a professional capacity, but we're all in this together.
Yes.
So, right. We need
and if
to work
we
together.
Had the emotional maturity and the knowledge and the background of what you're trying to teach, wouldn't that be great to benefit those, you know, in your social network and, you know, person A's social network? I think it's so important. I know, like, when I lost my mom, there were friends that really knew what to do, what to say. And there were friends that didn't know. And so therefore they backed away and it changed the course of our friendship. You know, there's so much to say on this topic and it just doesn't get talked about.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Marcy, first, let me just say that you're making your mom so proud by the work that you're doing. And I know that the best of her is living through you. It's upsetting when we don't get the time with our loved ones that we really hope to have. And that those cycles of kind of hope and grief are what I've spent a lifetime really thinking about. And there's no easy answer for any of this. It's really just finding empathy for yourself and for those around you. And Brené Brown talks about empathy, you know, the difference between sympathy is when you're saying words like, well, at least this, or, you know, oh, try this, or did you think about this? Like we have a tendency as human beings to go into a sympathetic mode, which is more like a fix mode. And empathy really isn't about that. Empathy really is just, you know, holding hands in the darkness with a person, just saying, I see you, I'm here, what can I do for you? You know, how can I help? And sometimes it's just really not saying anything. It's just deep listening. And that's why I say
creating that space.
Yes. Just creating space.
Yeah. Yeah.
To let whatever emotions are going to come up, just express themselves without trying to stifle them or redirect them or change them in any way.
Well, your organization is beautiful. So tell us a little bit about it. Did you have a career and then move into this? And has this always been in the back of your mind that you wanted to, to create?
Yeah. Well, thank you. Thank you for that prompt. It's our 25th anniversary this year. So I'm 54. I've been kind of operationalizing my passion for families living with these experiences. I did start my career in technology. So I was at IBM for 10 years, working in predominantly media and entertainment. Entertainment's our number one export in the United States. And so I had the great privilege of working with some of the biggest brands on the planet, the Walt Disney Company and Sony and 20th Century Fox, now 21st Century Fox. And in those experiences, what I realized is that the best campaigns, the best way to reach and aggregate groups of people is to connect at a heart level. And so I didn't really realize it, but that early technology perspective, you know, mobile first and multilingual and now AI-driven kind of technology activations became a foundational element for how we bring emotional relief into our RARE community today. So it's all about connecting at the heart level. Everything you'll see in our RARE Givers Emotional Journey Map, in our guidebook, in our exercises, in our website, everything we do is free and downloadable and available to the public. We have some really wonderful partnerships with Microsoft and other large global technology providers to be able to bring our solutions in a multilingual. You know, if you're going to talk about feelings, you have to talk to people in their native tongue, right? We can't just expect the world to speak English and you know, connect authentically. And so we kind of know that. So yeah, my whole career has kind of had this backdrop of working in technology, working in entertainment, but really working to bring people together. And I started an organization back in the year 2000 with a group of Pi Beta Phi sorority sisters from UCLA. We wanted to do what so many families in RARE wanted to do. We wanted to raise money for a cure for MPS2 or Hunter syndrome. So we did what 20-year-olds do best. We threw parties. So we just started like throwing a bunch of parties on Sunset Boulevard, inviting, you know, VIPs and people to make donations to our cause. And we are one of the few that actually have an FDA-approved treatment for Hunter syndrome. So I've witnessed the full cycle of philanthropy and rare disease, raising money, going through clinical trial, getting an FDA-approved treatment, and young men that would have passed away in their teens, like my brothers, are going off to college now. So it's an extraordinary part of the journey. But what really hit me is that there's still zero cures after my 50 years on the planet. You know, we have 100 years of science and we're still not there yet. And so everybody's in emotional crisis, right? So how do we bring relief into a system where everybody is suffering emotionally? And that's what RARE Givers is attempting to do.
There's so many rare diseases out there. And while your brother's disease doesn't necessarily touch mitochondria, we're all different arms of this big, you know, grouping of rare disease. And if we could learn from each other and come together more, you know, maybe there could be further advancements faster and, you know, in terms of the emotional aspect, but also in terms of true treatment and therapies and things like that.
And the science. I believe in our lifetime, and AI is accelerating the drug development cycles, you know, exponentially. So I do believe in our lifetime, we're going to see more treatments and cures. But there's some things that we can learn from other very mature care circles, care environments, military and veterans caregiving. For example, right? Predictable traumas. You make a choice to go into the military, whether it's a direct experience or a secondary experience, there's a predictable trauma that's going to happen. And so how does the military, you know, institutionalize a culture of support? And it was actually in the United States, it was Obama that put in an executive order that every man or woman released from active military duty had to name a primary care partner. So whether that's a spouse or a parent or just a friend or a doctor, but somebody, when that individual exited that system, that would be there checking in emotionally with that human being, right? And so you look at that and you go, okay, well, we can mandate this. There's, you know, we could opt in. So I invite everybody, take the pledge for self-care, you know, come to raregivers.global and take the pledge. But the way that we change the system of support is, you know, plan on a page. That's what we always said at IBM. If you're going to try to change things globally, you better be able to express it in one single piece of paper, right? And so the caregiver's emotional journey map is exactly that. It's a guide for the common emotional experience that we're all going through. And quite frankly, it's relative far outside of rare and chronic conditions, but we focus in this area because this is our passion and that's where the research came from. We've got 287 pieces of published research behind building the emotional journey map. But these are common experiences. This is, you know, six stages. They're not linear stages. This is more like chutes and ladders, you know,
right.
it's never, you know, a straightforward, but the six stages are noticing change either in yourself or a loved one, adjusting with or without a diagnosis. We know the diagnostic journeys can be, you know, 6, 7, 8 years on average, misdiagnosed 3 times on average. So these are sort of kind of ongoing experiences, but you might be in the ER and be worried about stage 5, which is end of life. Even though you're not actively in an end of life experience, you're still grieving, you know, what you thought your life was going to look like or your loved one's life was going to look like, right? So you're in the grief cycles of an end of life or really like an end of idea experience. And then stages 3 and 4, you know, shifting responsibilities within the family, the realities of full-time care. For some families, the unimaginable realities of managing, you know, epileptic seizures 24/7 or, you know, chronic pain or just you don't need me to name the unimaginable because we are living it in our,
right.
in our
I'm sure all of our listeners have all, a list going.
There's
right?
like our triage
yes.
list, right? It's like, oh my God, let's all, you know, traumatize each other and share, you know, our sister. And I get
we
to say that.
We can go on all day.
We can go on all day, but I get to say that because actually, I am also a patient. I'm a breast cancer survivor. So I'll be 9 years breast cancer free this October, which is a miracle. And I'm so grateful to God and family and doctors and, you know, good, healthy living and loving, you know, that I'm still here on the planet because I didn't even know if I was going to see my daughter graduate from high school and she's graduating in 3 weeks. And I'm just like, oh, I'm just so, so grateful every single day, right? So it's that last stage, I think, finding meaning, right, in this everyday, difficult, unimaginable experience that we live. It's the finding meaning that helps you kind of wake up in the morning, okay, I can do another day, hopefully go to bed with 1 or 2 joyful moments. Right? Just a moment. And it could be a short moment, but just reminding yourself that just being on the planet is a privilege and we're here together. And I'm so glad to be here with you on this podcast, Marcy. I mean, thank you for reaching out and making this happen.
I mean, the organization really spoke to me and I feel like people at every age could really benefit. I mean, I know my friends were not necessarily prepared for everything I was dishing out in my 20s, you know, when my mom was really sick and I was getting my diagnosis and it was just, I was a heavy friend to have, you know, in the figurative sense. And I want everyone to be more compassionate. You know, I mean, I do have friends that were amazing. Like, don't get me wrong, but I think we could all be such better people to those around us, you know, with this training. And it could be disease, it could be addiction, it could be, you know, so many different things out there. You know, we talk a lot as we've gotten to know one another, and you've brought up like feelings and being able to talk about it. You know, what do you think about like the mental health crisis that is continuing to impact us, and how rare givers are a big piece of that? How do you make sense of all of that together?
Yeah. So modern culture, chronic stress, right? Mental health, emotional well-being. These are part of our vernacular. It's part of our like everyday conversation now. You see it in the headlines. You're seeing, you know, the good news for all of us, I think, as a species, on the planet, is that we were humbled together collectively during the pandemic. So the pandemic was a forced reset emotionally for the planet, because it just affected everybody, and in small and deeply tragic ways. But if you notice, just in the last, you know, 4 or 5 years, people that we look up to, athletes, Olympians, entertainers, singers, politicians, others are saying, wait, I need to tend to myself first before I can perform for you, before I can do the job that I'm here to do. So there's much more recognition and much more grace, I think, being offered in our modern culture to doing what we have been doing for millennia. You know, we used to be a lot better at getting enough sleep. We used to be a lot better at eating natural foods. We used to be, you know, really naturally engaged in our bodies and in community and close relationship with each other within our villages. And so, you know, going back to the ancient arts, going back to that deep intuition and that sort of that soulful knowledge that sits within all of us is what we are all about at Rare Givers. So, you know, we talk about the journey map, we talk about the guidebooks, but what you'll see is kind of experiential reminders to take 3 deep breaths while your coffee's brewing, you know, to step out and get some sunshine on your face if you're able to, you know, within the conditions that we're all living with. So it's those reminders of, or permissions. You know, the number one thing we hear from caregivers especially is, I don't have time for self-care. I don't have time for self-care, right? I got this triage list of things I have to do for my loved one. But that is coming at such a profound cost. It's coming at a cost that I don't even think we've tapped the surface of measuring. We're starting to, you know, NORD, National Organization of Rare Disorders, Global Genes, Rare Disease International, you know, National Caregivers Association, Mental Health America, NAMI. Organizations all over the world are trying to quantify the impact, not just of the physical experience of rare and chronic disease, but also the emotional and the sort of the community impact, the quality of the family impact. And we talked about, you know, the chronic stress of caring for my brothers really broke my parents apart. They didn't have the words as 19-year-old parents, and, you know, certainly time went by, so 20, 30, even 30-year-old parents. They didn't have the words within the relationship to talk about, how do we care for others and care for ourselves? How do we nurture ourselves and keep our relationship strong? So it wasn't until 35 years later, after 2 sets of marriages, you know, that my parents kind of reunited and started hashing out the conversations from, you know, from the 1980s. So these are lifelong journeys, and I guess that's sort of the message, right?
Yeah.
We think we're so unique, journey. But
right,
really,
right.
We're not that unique. we're just hearts trying to connect, and that, you know, that's what Rare Givers is about.
Do you think social media is tough for people that, number one, have a rare disease and are struggling, and in addition, those that are spending so much of their time caring for their loved one, and that they don't have time to, you know, do all these fun and cool things that they see their contemporaries doing? Do you think that impacts the mental health crisis and the way people feel about themselves?
For sure it does. I mean, we spend a lot of time talking about dualities. Okay, so hope and grief, light and dark, you know, the positive and the negative of social media, right? And the ability to connect on a global basis with people that are going through the experience that you're going through, either as a patient or as a care partner or even professionally, right? The ability to do that because of the digital enablement that's happened is extraordinary.
I would never want to get rid of it for that reason.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
And then the duality, the flip side of that is it's extraordinarily painful. You know, one of the witnessing this kind of, you know, objectively or subjectively or, you know, falsely or real presentation of life is difficult for everybody, even more so, you know, in our community. And one of the first studies that we did was sort of just a questionnaire. It was a survey. And we surveyed rare mothers in particular across the country of the United States. And about 30 to 35% were not on Facebook, couldn't actually fathom being on Facebook. Such an expectation of, you know, positivity and reporting updates. And there is no good news to share today. I don't have good news to share today, you know. So we realized that we're going to need to find other ways to connect. And so we always make a point of connecting remotely, connecting virtually, creating opportunities for that individual to connect in their space with things that are physical. So we use sight, sound, taste, touch, and smell as ways to ground epiphanies, ground emotions, ground connection that we are establishing through these virtual channels, whether it's social media or, you know, Zoom groups or Teams. To be able to come together is extraordinarily powerful, but to step in, you know, as we're sitting here, okay, let me give you my sight, sound, taste, touch, and smell, because you can't see it right now, but I've got my Wonder Woman mug in my hand with a warm cup of coffee that I lovingly prepared before this podcast. I have in the background this beautiful bouquet that came from a senior recognition event. I mean, the colors are just extraordinary. So they're uplifting. I have on my lap a blanket that I actually paid 48 euros for, which sounds ridiculous, but I went on a women's retreat in Portugal just a couple weeks ago. And I got so connected to this blanket. It was a yoga retreat, but I got so connected because I had all these emotional epiphanies during the yoga, you know, because when you relax, your mind opens up and your soul opens up. Right. So I was like, I have to bring this blanket home because everything I'm feeling is all wrapped up in this blanket. So literally sight, sound, taste, touch, and smell are all activated right now. And I try to tap into those every day because those are the things that settle my soul and allow me to hold space. And I really do, you know, I do have to say a word about faith. Because there's a surrendering that I've had to learn over the decades. And my faith has allowed me to just not try to fix, not try to come in as the expert, not come in as anything other than I'm just a girl, now a woman, now a mother, now a wife, certainly always a daughter, but I'm just a human heart, trying to speak a truth that I hope will resonate literally on a global basis. And our goal is for that to resonate with 3.5 million people by next year. Why 3.5 million people? Because that's 1% of the need, right? So we have 350 million, some say 400 million in our community. But we figure if we can get rare givers to resonate with 1%, that will be a catalyst. That will be a catalyst that will ignite people like you, like the listeners, like everyone, you know, collectively in this community to think about themselves. Sight, sound, taste, touch, smell. Hopefully those five senses are available to you, but we know they're not available to everybody. But just pick a dominant sense. Just pick something and just take a moment, steal that moment back for yourself. And then that shores you up so that you can pay it forward, right? So I always say that the purpose of suffering is to sow the seeds of empathy. It's to marinate your heart in the pain so that you can actually look on, literally look somebody in the eye or connect with them at a heart level and be there for them.
Yeah.
When they're going through their pain. So it's not about us. It's about them.
Right.
It's the collective other, right?
So Yeah. For sure. I always think to myself, like, okay, I've gone through this. Like, what would I want someone, you know, what would I want someone to say to me, you know, or how would I want someone to handle me? And so I try to, you know, pay it forward that way. But hopefully not everyone has lived so much trauma, you know, like you. Like, there's a lot of loss at a very young age. And it's scary to sometimes even to unload that on someone else, you know? So going back to what you were saying, so there's so much within your organization. There's so many things you can find on your site. What would you want a listener to do to get involved with your organization? What could their step one be?
Sure. Well, it's like anything. I mean, we are all different. We all engage and learn and open up differently. So that's why I talk about sight, sound, taste, touch, smell. I talk about the senses because there's a lot of different ways to engage with the same message, which is self-care. I mean, it's a very simple message, you know, heal thyself first, right? It's sort of like we sort of know that intellectually, but we don't always give ourselves emotional permission to do that. So if you like to listen to podcasts, I'm guessing you do because you're listening to this one, but others may want to download a journey map. Others may want to download the guidebook and read. Literally, like, I need the detail. I need the exercises. You know,
we have I these love deep the guidebook.
Exercises. Yay. I'm so glad. It's, you know, it's taken 7 years and
a
several
lot of
hundred
thought went
hands.
Into that.
Yes.
Yeah.
When our listeners go through the guidebook, I feel like they're going to be just like nodding their head constantly, you know, at what they're reading and feeling really attuned to like the words on the page. So I'm excited for them to kind of kick off possibly with that.
Yes.
But you're
yes.
right. Not everyone is the same.
Well, not everybody's the same. And so that's why, you know, the plan on a page, right? So having a map, literally, that you can find yourself in. And I've presented this map in every format you can imagine. I mean, you know, we've run 20 cohorts of families, professionals, patients, various different caregivers, various different disease communities all over the world. You know, almost 800 people have gone through this training and it evolved. We're on version 9.1 right now. Now you have to lock it because if you don't lock it, then you can't translate it. So we just locked it a few months ago and now we're working with Microsoft to translate into 400 languages. We've already done 12, kind of the 12 main most spoken languages on the planet. But now we're working on 400. And did you know there's actually 6,000 dialects? So AI enables us to be able to connect people into a system of support, have a common language, even if they're speaking in another language. So that's where this is going. And I think that's what there's an opportunity, you know, whether you're watching one of our videos on YouTube, or you're joining a live support group, because we have support groups, or, you know, tapping into a wellness retreat. We just established a partnership with We Are Brave Together, which runs in-person support groups and wellness retreats across the country of the United States. We're hoping to expand them into our global network and run those retreats around the world. So, you know, it's the same message. It's awareness. It's vocabulary about how to use the words to describe the feelings that you're feeling.
Right.
So it's
right.
The same message. It's
I
just
think people
expressed.
Get caught up on the on the vocabulary, especially when they're looking to support someone else. They think they don't have it.
Yes, they don't, but they do. If you pull things up high enough, you get out of the specific symptom management. You get out of the triage list. You get even out of the science of the condition, and you get into this common experience, emotional experience. Everyone's going to find themselves somewhere on this journey map, and you're going to find some elements of relief, because these aren't something new that we came up with. These are the ancient arts, right? These are the things that we know.
That's
that
a really interesting point. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You're just developing the, like, you're prioritizing the thought.
Yes. Yes. Well, there's kind of essential things. I've mentioned them before, but we know we need good sleep. We know that we need to eat well. We know that it's important to pause, be mindful about the interactions that we're having with other people within our family unit, within our social circles, within our work environments. But it's, you know, it's like, again, that intuitive wisdom where you know you need to tend to your own emotions, or at least recognize them before, you know, engaging with others. So whether you see yourself in this, or, you know, we have a lot of families that are using the journey map with teachers. Let me describe with you
what
my
idea.
Child's going through
yeah.
and what we are
We've
going
talked
through
about that
as
on a
family.
Lot of episodes. Yeah.
Yes.
About the parents having to deal with new teachers every year and the school administrations. And that's a great point.
Yes. Yes. And then it's, you know, you'll notice the color schemes. This is very Disney-esque looking.
Yeah.
It's very friendly.
I could see
it's
that.
Very
yeah.
Approachable. It's, you know, we're working on an interactive version, which will be like
wow.
a gamified version for people
okay.
to walk them through
yeah.
selves, you know, learnings and everything everywhere all the time, right? That's mm-hmm. that's what we have to do, but
that's the world we live
that's
in.
How we're
I don't
gonna
know that I love
relief.
It yet, but
yeah, everything everywhere all the time. Yeah. Exactly.
Well, you've been such a pleasure to talk with. I love what you're doing. And honestly, I feel like I am healing more learning about your organization, even though, you know, my days right now aren't as a rare giver. You know, those, unfortunately, my mom is gone and she's the person that I was really taking care of. But I can appreciate so much of what you're teaching and that what, as I said before, like what you're prioritizing for people to take note of, you know, and you never know when you're going to also be put in the position to need it or support someone in this way. So you're doing amazing work, and there's so many ways to get involved with Rare Givers, and I'm going to have some great links and notes in the show notes. So I thank you all for listening, and Crystal, thank you so much for being here.
Absolutely. Well, I made a promise at the beginning of this podcast. So if you
yes.
made it all the way
Hollywood
through to the
ending.
End, the Hollywood
let's
ending,
it.
Let's hear it. I gave you a little bit in the middle, but really that couple, Richard and Phyllis, that connected as 16-year-olds, married at 19, had a basketball team of kids, 5 kids, 4 older brothers and myself, and 3 that passed away, David, Jared, and Randy. At 18, 19 and 12 years old. The caregiving stress broke them apart. So they divorced in 1975. They each remarried, second marriages, divorced. They each remarried third marriages, long, 20-year-long marriages, and they widowed within a year of each other. So that 35 years apart, you know, created a lot of learning and a lot of words and education. And the same year that they lost their partners, Chloe, our daughter, the granddaughter, came into the family. And so she was born 18 years ago. My parents got back together and they were together for 16 years. And just last year, we remarried them. 60 years after the first time in 1963, they got married again at 80 in 2023. So yeah, that's the Barrett family story. We call it Grin and Barrett.
You can see it on our YouTube. That's a good hashtag. And your daughter doesn't know life without them being together, which is kind of beautiful.
They're just grandma and grandma to her. Exactly. No, I just think it's a power and sort of like the testimony to forgiveness and unconditional love. And
they're clearly meant to be together.
And that no matter how dark and difficult life can be, that there's an opportunity for renewal, finding joy, finding the bright spots in life. So so that's our story.
Well, it's a really beautiful one. Thank you for sharing it with us. And Crystal, thank you so much for being a part of our podcast.
Thank you for joining us. I encourage you to browse other Energy in Action podcast episodes. I am so inspired by the resilience of those in previous episodes, and I know you will be too.